From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For four decades, John Burns has been reporting the hottest stories around the world for the New York Times, from Johannesburg, Moscow, China, Bosnia, India, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, most recently out of London. In the thick of war, upheaval, shifting power, and lots of human life. Now Burns, one of the greatest correspondents of his time, is hanging up his notebook, retiring. He's with us this hour on Point, John Burns, on what he's learned in the world. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question on the world we've known, the world we see now, for John Burns? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Cambridge in England is John Burns, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and many more reporting honors, who's just retired after 40 years at the New York Times, 39 of them on the international desk. John Burns, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, it's entirely a pleasure.
There's so much we want to look at in this big world, enormous stories, and you've reported from the heart of so many, but take us back to a couple of your most memorable and lauded stories, if you'd be kind enough, John. 1992, Sarajevo, and the cellist in the streets as the howitzer shells rained down on that city. Would you put us back there?
You know, a great deal of life, I think, in any profession comes down to sheer blind luck. I had re-entered Sarajevo after all the other correspondents had withdrawn under a white flag in mid-May of 1992, because the city was being murdered almost under our eyes. I was outside the Serb siege lines, but I could see the incendiary shells, the mortars, the artillery shells hitting the buildings, and the city was on fire. And I thought, it cannot be right that the eyes of the world have been put out. Somebody has to be there. So I went back in on a Friday afternoon, which was a calculation that the editors wouldn't notice from an absence of any entry for me on what we call the whereabouts list, that I'd done that, and that I could chronicle the murder of this city over a weekend, get out, and be forgiven for having, in effect, disobeyed orders. And so I went in, and the scene was more terrible than I could possibly imagine, and I spent what was left of the Friday, the Saturday, and the Sunday reporting and climbing up the hills to the parklands that were being turned into graveyards, the soccer fields that were being turned into graveyards, the dead bodies lying in the street. I'd never seen anything like it in my life, all with a view to getting filing on the Sunday evening and then getting out. Well, as it happened, the option to get out was destroyed almost as soon as I arrived, because my rented car was hit by a mortar shell, which literally blew it into two halves. But nonetheless, I thought it important to get that story on the Sunday evening. I was writing in a hideaway I had found, where I judged myself to be somewhat less likely to be hit by one of these shells, when a young photographer, Andrew Reed, a very good friend of mine, New Zealander, who's gone on to make a great success of his life as a farmer and as an ocean yachtsman in New Zealand, came to me in my cranny hideaway and said, "You've got to come with me." And I said, "Andrew, I can't afford to. This story is too big. My career might depend on getting this right." Mm-hmm. He said, "Believe me, you won't regret it." So I followed him out in a state of some agitation down what was called the walking street in Sarajevo, which was totally deserted, and there were artillery shells hitting the buildings all about us. It was a truly ghoulish, satanic scene. And there was this man in evening dress sitting on a plastic chair on the site of what we came to know as the Breadline bombing, where 26, as I recall, people had been killed a few days earlier.
Standing in a breadline.
Standing in a breadline. Mm-hmm. And this was Vedran Smilovic, the chief cellist of the Sarajevo Symphony Orchestra, playing Albinoni's Adagio in G. It was just a moment of arresting beauty.
In the street, in the open air, with the shells raining down on this city.
And just he and I, Andrew had already taken a photograph of him, so he wasn't there. And as anybody who loves great music will know, the Adagio is quite a long piece. So I hid in the lee of one of the stronger buildings about 20 yards up the street until he finished, and then as he packed up his cello and came over to the side of the street, I asked him if he would talk to me, and I'll never forget.
Who said, who's
buying the whiskey?
That's not a bad opening for a good interview.
And there was, in fact, a very nice bar, Croatian bar, where they played the most magnificent Croatian folk music, which I recommend to anybody who doesn't know it. Beautiful music. And he told me a story, and the thing that I recall about that conversation was his answer when I said to him, why are you doing this? You know, you're not climbing the hills and trying to stop the people shooting these artillery shells at the city. And he said, obviously, and he was, as I was, a rather unfit middle-aged man. And he said, I'm not equipped for that, so I'm going to do what I can do, and this is the only thing I can do. And it turned out that that was a sort of theme for the 250,000 people left in that city.
He said to you, you quoted him saying, my mother is a Muslim, my father is a Muslim,
yes,
but I don't care. I am a Sarajevan, I am a cosmopolitan, I am a pacifist, I'm nothing special, I'm a musician, I'm part of the town like everyone else, I do what I can. But he tried to represent that. Not a partisan, not a someone in a conflict, but a citizen, a resident, a human.
Yeah, his voice was obviously utterly compelling, utterly simple, as they usually are, speaking from the heart with no filter. And so I ran back to my hideaway and completely rewrote my story. And, of course, it made for Vedran, although it wasn't his intent, I'm sure. It gave him a whole new career. He spent much of the last 20 years traveling the world, playing as a guest player, cellist, with many of the great orchestras of the world. He's written a book. Books have been written about him. There's a novel called The Cellist of Sarajevo. And he now lives in Ireland, still playing his cello, as best I know.
It was an amazing, amazing picture that you brought to the world. Of course, the photographs to go with it, the shells raining down, and the Sarajevan standing up for a kind of humanity there. Tell us one more, John, if you would, out of a couple years later, three or four, out of Kandahar in Afghanistan. We've all come to know it now, but you were there as a couple of lovers had been charged with adultery. They would be stoned to death by the Taliban.
Yeah, I had. I've come to think. I hope it's not too grand a claim that about 90% of success in life is just showing up. And a lot of my brothers and sisters in the press corps in Afghanistan had not shown up in Kandahar, which was the seat of the Taliban as they extended their power north and east across Afghanistan. And there was a very simple reason, and that was that there was what was once known as the Eisenhower Highway, built with American aid money between Kabul and Kandahar.
Yes.
And it had been as little as a 3.5-hour drive, but by the time that I attempted it with a pal, it was about a 4-day drive. And it was not terribly safe, to put it at its mildest. It was you passed through perhaps 300, 400 Taliban checkpoints, and none of them were very friendly. And I arrived in Kandahar, and I heard about this couple, and I set about reporting it as best I could. And it was a devastating story, but captured the tragedy of Afghanistan's resort under duress to the extreme fundamentalism that we have seen spread much further afield in the 20 years since.
You wrote the condemned woman, Noor Bibi, 40, was lowered into a pit dug into the earth beside the outer wall around the mosque until only her chest and head were above ground. Her son was there. Her lover also taken aside. They would all be stoned. The first round of stoning, and then her son comes up to check if his mother is still alive. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, he had to throw the first stone. I mean, it's ghastly beyond words, but, you know, anybody who has listened to the radio, watched television, or read a newspaper in the last year, of course, has seen a regular drumbeat of this kind of horror done in the name of Islam. Of course, an distorted, extreme, vengeful form of Islam. I won't say it began there in Kandahar, but I think we saw its first and most ghastly expressions in the early rule of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And, you know, incidents like that really tell themselves. And it was great relief to me to find at some point in my career, because I found it terribly stressful in my early years at the New York Times. I never really believed I deserved a job there. I lived in constant fear, unnecessarily, as I think now, of getting the boot. I think it's, by the way, a default position of many people in our business, yes, particularly foreign correspondents. And I discovered that, you know, if you follow one primary rule, which is to go, set out. You won't get anything if you just sit by a typewriter or a computer in a hotel in the capital. Just go out there. You may not be sure of what you're going to find, but you are surely going to find something. And I sometimes felt like I had a sort of angel on my shoulder, that just the act of going created the dramas upon which I fell.
John Burns, please stand by in Cambridge, England. It's a pleasure, an honor to have you with us. John Burns retiring after nearly 40 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, covering some of the biggest stories in the world. You've just heard a couple of intimate, moving stories right there. We're going to pull the curtain back, look large at affairs of state, humanity, the world. John Burns has seen a lot. Here is a bit of that adagio with Vedran Smelovich playing, not in the street, but a bit later. John Burns, please stand by. It's great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with famed, longtime global correspondent John Burns. He's retiring after covering the world for 40 years for the New York Times. We're looking to hear, to harvest, some of what he has learned in all that time. He joins us today from Cambridge in England, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, showered with many more honors as well. He has reported from Johannesburg, Moscow, China, Bosnia, India, Afghanistan, Iraq, London, Libya, you name it, he's been in the thick of it, truly celebrated correspondent. I've got lots of questions for you, John, but let's get some right from our listeners. Laura in New Berlin, Wisconsin, you're on the air with John Burns. Thanks for calling, Laura.
Hi. Just a quick observation up front. Really appreciate the descriptors of the guest. Ghastly, ghoulish, satanic, they ring true. And as a result, Mr. Burns, would you conclude humankind is a failed species based on what you've witnessed, what you've experienced? Thank you.
What a wonderful question. Actually, no. In fact, exactly the opposite. And when I say this, I always feel that there's a danger of lapsing into sanctimony and self-righteousness, which I loathe. It's actually been my experience that for all of the horrors of war, which we know well and which speak for the darkest instincts in the human soul, war and other afflictions generate an equal and opposite, I would say even greater reaction, almost a law of physics, where humanity expresses itself in the most glorious ways, where quite ordinary people very often become quite extraordinary, in their courage, in their endurance, their acceptance of adversity, in maintaining a sense of humor, a sense of decency, in helping each other. And, you know, along with the, which is undeniable, it would be vain to deny it, there's a great exhilaration operating as a foreign correspondent very often on that narrow margin between life and oblivion. It is exhilarating. And that enough might have been enough to draw me back, like the butterfly, the moth to the flame. But in the long run, and as I got older, it was that other thing, the glorious qualities in human nature that I came to love about my job.
And yet, John, you can look at the arc of your career, that period of time, which began when the Cold War was still very much on and so frightening. Cold War ended. began when apartheid was still a big focus of people fighting for justice in the world. You covered it in part in South Africa. Apartheid ended. The Berlin Wall came down. There was a sense that we might be headed into this, you know, lovely green meadow of a future. And that great sense of hope for a less fearsome world has really faded a lot. Who can miss the noble moments of our species? But to Laura's question, are we bobbling? Are we fumbling our chance at really making a better go of it?
Well, I was never one who subscribed. It's a little unfair because I think the book was more complicated than this, but mm-hmm. Francis Fukuyama's The End of History. I was never that optimistic, but I cannot say that I foresaw, certainly not comprehensively, the demons that would arise once the carapace of the Cold War was lifted, the revival of the old gods, the gods that had haunted the 19th and the 20th century, which came back over the last 20, 25 years with a terrific ferocity and resulted in these regional, ethnic, religious conflicts which now consume so much of the world. I wish I could say I had foreseen it. I don't think I was alone in not foreseeing it. And optimism is, after all, so much more attractive than pessimism. I believed, as I suppose so many others did in 1989, that my children, who were then youngsters, who are now in their 30s, would grow up into a much more congenial and benign world. Now I spend a good deal of my time worrying about the world into which they will bring their children, what kind of world it will be when they are middle-aged. And I have to say the auguries are not good. But there is still, again, my wife would say, don't please get into your preaching mode. There is an enormous amount of good in the world, and it seems to me that where evil presently prevails, we will see this counterforce applying itself. It's sometimes difficult to see it. Iraq and Syria. How is the Islamic State going to be rolled back? By force of arms, somewhat, but you know, all the force of arms that have been applied to date have only rolled it back, the Islamic estate back by about 25% at the most. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think that humanity will prevail. Was it? I'm not much of a man for rap music, but Tupac Shakur.
Shakur, yeah.
I think he rapped. He sang, if that's the right word.
Yes.
About the rose that pokes through the concrete. And it does. History has shown that over and over again, that times of affliction give rise to equal forces of goodness, of benediction, call it what you will. I'm not sure that I'll be around to see it, since I've passed 70 now, but I still live in hope that my grandchildren will grow up into a less afflicted world.
You wrote very movingly in the New York Times over the weekend about what you've brought back from all those years of reporting. You described your great friend, Tiziano Terzani, the Italian writer with Der Spiegel and more. I was lucky enough to know Tiziano in my years in Asia. We crossed paths in Hong Kong and the Philippines and China, and tremendous guy. And he said, it's not what you see out in the field, it's what you bring home. And one of the things that you brought home, you wrote there, was an abiding revulsion for ideology in all of its guises. Mm. We're gearing up for a new presidential campaign season in the United States now, a time when ideology tends to become more, not less, prominent, I think. What about ideology? And are you just talking about the darkest days of Maoist China there, or the Soviet Union, or are you looking more widely?
Well, of course, I think primarily of those nasty places where I spent perhaps three quarters of my career. So to conclude from that ideology was a vicious thing and destroyed all around it, and I mean all, that it left nothing untouched. But it was a disappointment to me when I came home. There were many, many joys of coming home, and coming home with the generosity of the New York Times to an assignment in my own country where I'd grown up, but I'd never really known England. I'd never worked here. It was a disappointment to see how readily people in our age, who have the freedom to think for themselves, fall into the same patterns, not with the same ferocity, not with the same degree of evil, of ceding the freedom of thought to organized systems of belief, usually with an ism at the end of it, which appears to license the most rigid kind of thinking, and is characterized by some of the same, in fact, many of the same characteristics that you see in the nasty ideologies, which cost so many tens of millions of lives in the 20th century. And of course, we're talking about entirely different things here. But the propensity to misappropriate language, to use the word violence, for example, and I've seen what violence means in the nastiest places in the world, to describe something that does not involve physical force, to try to obliterate the opponent, disparage and obliterate the opponent completely, a sort of absolutism and intolerance, and whether it's, there's liberalism, conservatism, and many other kinds of isms, and sometimes my heart cries out when listening to our airwaves here in the United States and reading the public prints, when people who have considerable influence in public life embrace these orthodoxies, if you will, these organized systems of thought and doctrine, and to my mind, to obscure truth instead of to illuminate it. And I think it would be well for people who are inclined to fall into these isms to think hard about that. I, for a while, found myself being assailed, once we became an interactive profession, by bloggers who described me, and it became a bit perplexing. Sometimes they damned me for being a liberal, sometimes they damned me for being a conservative. And while struggling to decide which I was, I concluded I wasn't any of them. I didn't fall into the categories because I found that none of them suited what my experience of drawing from the facts, of seeking, and that Tiziano Terzani, who you mentioned, who I spent a wonderful last weekend with after his daughter's wedding in the Basilica in
Italy,
Florence. Speaking at his, I didn't write about this in the Times, but speaking at his daughter's wedding the day before, we met up in his beautiful house above the Arno, and he spoke about what he had brought back. He spoke about the unifying principle in life. Not a bad thing to talk about when your only daughter is getting married.
And he was dying of cancer.
Dying of cancer, of the need to bend your efforts to bringing people together, to finding a common middle ground. And I found that a very important and instructive lesson.
John Burns writes in the Times, "It can be depressing beyond words to hear the loyalists of any given political creed, whether of the left or right, adopt the unyielding certainties common in totalitarian states," a view that he's brought home from all those decades abroad. My pile of questions is large, but listeners want to bring in theirs as well. Josh in Montreal, Canada, you're on with John Burns. Josh.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi. What an honor to hear your guest on the air. I'd like, as a kind of a minor scribbler who was in Berlin in those days when everyone was so euphoric and elated about the end of the Cold War, to ask Mr. Burns, now 70 years after the end of the Second World War, we see a new conflict in the Ukraine, which seems to be dragging on, a kind of with potential for becoming a long-term, maybe even perpetual conflict. And I want to ask Mr. Burns, does he see a kind of arc of instability developing in that part of the world, going from the Baltics all the way down to the Caucasus?
On the Russian border, if you will. John Burns?
I do. I think it's an extremely dangerous situation, extremely challenging for the West, because I think none of us wants to contemplate what armed conflict with the Soviet Union would mean, and God grant that that is precluded by, as it was during the Cold War, by the principle of mutual assured destruction. But it does seem at the moment that Vladimir Putin is behaving in ways that do actually have some quite forceful resonance from the situation in Europe in the late 1930s. I think you don't want to go too far in comparing anybody to Hitler, who was, of course, one of the most evil, if not the most evil man who ever strode the earth. But I think Vladimir Putin pose a real threat to the stability. That great arc caused by what Winston Churchill called the Iron Curtain, and it's an enormous challenge for NATO to know how to meet it. We do have to meet it. We do have to show resolve and hope that in the long run that it will be the Russian people who will solve this as their economy goes dark on them as a result of the sanctions to which they're now subject, that they will come to see the evil that is the potential in Vladimir Putin, in which case we could all breathe a lot easier, but that's a far from sure thing.
John, what about Europe's role? It came out of the age of imperialism so powerful it couldn't help but have a huge imprint on the world. Then the two great wars of the 20th century, and then in the last decades, what feels, at least from the United States, like a kind of retreat. There's been a lot of talk lately about the UK, where you're sitting now, pulling back from a long-time international role, often at the elbow of the United States. What about Europe's imprint on the world in this century? Does it retreat into a minor role?
I don't think so. I can speak with more authority, of course, about my native country, the United Kingdom, than I can about other parts of Europe, though, of course, I've traveled and reported quite widely there. But I think that the Atlantic Alliance, which has, under the United States leadership, has maintained peace in the world for the last, 70 years since the Second World War, the arc of my entire life. I was born... My father was a fighter pilot in the Second World War, and I was born in the closing months of 1944. Yeah. I grew up, he was a NATO commander. I used to fly with him on low-level reconnaissance flights, some of them to places where I'm sure that NATO would not wish it be known that they were going in those days. Yeah. So I grew up under his tutelage, really, with a tremendous respect for the United States and how it kept the peace in the world, and for the alliance that was built from 1949 on the NATO. I think that alliance is still pretty strong. I think European governments are struggling with the commitment to spend 2% of GDP on their defense. But, you know, the armed forces of France, of the United Kingdom, of Germany are still quite formidable. They worked extremely well together in Afghanistan. And I don't think that there's a headlong flight away from responsibility. I can see why the United States is concerned about waning defense spending. But we have enormous advantages in technology. And I think we're still a big force to be reckoned with. And if we doubt it, I think you just have to see how careful Mr. Putin is being not to light the blue touch paper. And he's gone a long way. He's calculating every day how far he can go. But I think he is well aware that there is a limit and that NATO and the West will ultimately show resolve. We already are. We've already moved force into the Baltic Republics. We've made it plain that any move against the Baltic Republics will be met under, I forget in which article of the NATO Charter it is, but the one for all provision of the NATO Charter. So on that score, I'm fairly optimistic. And I would say only this of my own native country, that whilst defense spending has perforce had to be cut because of the economic, the financial crunch of the last few years, we still have some pretty formidable men under uniform. And anybody who doubts that should speak to David Petraeus and other American commanders who had British troops fighting under their command in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with famed longtime global correspondent John Burns. He's retiring after covering the world for 40 years for the New York Times. Out of Johannesburg, Moscow, China, Bosnia, India, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya. He's in the UK today with us from Cambridge, England, and taking your questions. Just hit 70, and he's hanging it up, that long, long, illustrious career covering so many enormous stories in the world. John, lots of callers for you. Gina, in Coralville, Iowa. Gina, you're on the air with John Burns.
Thank you, Tom. My question is, why is what you say so one-sided? After all your years of experience, it seems like you talk from a very Western perspective and completely ignore anything else. I mean, you say that Putin is kind of close to Hitler, but the fact that NATO was crowning Hitler, Putin, you don't mention that. The fact that the United States almost destroyed Iraq, and that's what led to ISIS, you don't mention that. You talk about Islamic extremists. I don't understand why what you say is so one-sided.
Gina, we've got it. John Burns, what do you say?
Well, I have to say, I always hoped that when my time was done, and by the way, all this talk of retirement, I want to say that I'm going to fight the idea of retirement.
Oh, good. Okay, you're going to keep writing?
No, I'm going to continue writing for the New York Times on a contractual basis. They've encouraged me to try and keep in the paper as often as possible.
Good.
That'll keep me alert, get me
going.
Up in the morning.
Good, good.
And not condemn me to endless afternoons of shooting 85 or 90 on the golf course.
Right.
The question, I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate one, and I was thinking as you were talking about those issues. Of course, there is a different perspective. I can only say that my perspective, in the end, I was sent abroad to be, as I've often said, not neutral, but to be fair, to be neutral. Who was it who said, one of the ancients, that nothing quite so damnable as to be treat equally unequal things? And I cannot persuade myself that there is any equality morally between what the Soviet Union and its successor in the Russian Republic has set out to achieve in its relations with neighboring countries, and what the United States and its allies have done. And I certainly can't reckon on any kind of equality or equalization morally between the United States and for all that went wrong in Iraq and its intent in the world, and that of the Islamic State. I think you only have to ask yourself, what kind of a world would it be if the power now vested in the Western alliance, and particularly the United States, were instead vested in Russia or the Islamic State? And I think that that will lead you to conclusions really not so far different from my own.
What about China in that picture? It's changed a lot since you were there, you know, in the great proximity, still in the Mao Zedong era. What about Chinese leadership? Is that something that you would welcome, that you do welcome as it grows on the world stage?
Well, of course, anybody who lived in China as many years as I did can only rejoice at China lifting itself out of poverty. Mao Zedong said famously on the 1st of October 1949, when the Communist Republic was established, those famous words, "The Chinese people have stood up." Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly have stood up in the last, 30 years since I was imprisoned in China and kicked out, 1986, mm-hmm. 28 years, whatever that is. And it's been wondrous to see what the Chinese people offered their some degree of freedom, at least economically, financially, have achieved. On the other hand, of course, it's still governed by the Communist Party, and we have to be very wary of what their aims are. And if you doubt that, you should look back to the speeches that Deng Xiaoping made, secret speeches, one copy of one of which I got in my second assignment in China, where he's speaking to the Central Committee about what the objects of China's turn towards the open door and to free marketeering was all about. And he said it wasn't about the almighty dollar. It wasn't just about getting rich, it was about getting powerful, and as he said, returning China to its proper place in the world, which he said was as it had been at the end of the Ming Dynasty, when it was the number one nation in the world. I think that's something that would be regrettable. I think we're a lot safer, all of us, including, by the way, the Chinese people, in a world in which the predominant power still belongs to the United States. But obviously, China's going to assert itself, and we're going to have to live with this. I think there are going to be some limits to the expansion of Chinese power, which will be internally imposed. First of all, because the Chinese people are, as we know, very restless about the lack of political freedom. Secondly, if you look at China, for all of the talk that we've heard since the rise of the communists in China about imperialism and colonialism, China, as presently constructed on the map, is the result of the imperialism of the Chinese emperors. About 50% or more of the landmass of China is territories that were occupied or subsumed by the Chinese Empire. And, of course, Tibet is one perhaps arguable case, but Xinjiang to the west. And there's going to be a lot of unrest in these places, and the Chinese are going to have to bend a lot of their efforts to containing and accommodating that unrest. So I think that it's not going to happen in my lifetime. I wouldn't think in my children's lifetime, they now in their mid-30s, that China will become the number one political power in the world, but it's certainly going to have a great influence on the course of events.
Let me ask you, we heard on NPR this morning, on Morning Edition, they were talking with Hank Paulson, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary and big investment banker and more, who's spent a lot of time in China. He's got a new book out about China. He describes sitting down as he can at his altitude with Xi Jinping, who leads China now, and talking about forms of government. And coming away with Xi Jinping having been very clear that they do not seek, he does not seek an evolution toward Western-style democracy. That's just not what he sees or his party sees as best for China. We more or less opened this conversation with you talking about how you developed a distaste for ideology. And yet it's pretty clear where you're coming down. You say that, you know, you hope that predominant power still belongs to the United States. There are still preferences here. Is that an ideological preference on your point, John, or something
else? Well, just, I mean, very simple things. I think freedom of expression, all of the freedoms that are enshrined in the Constitution of the United States are a great deal better than their alternatives. And don't take it from me. Talk to the people in any town or village in China. That's not to say that the prescription should be that they adopt our form of civic society. I mean, that's what we offered in Iraq, and it was pretty resoundingly rejected, or at least it failed. I think that there are other forms of civil society that can be constructed than ours. But freedom is an irrepressible thing, the desire for freedom. And the Chinese Communist Party continues to deny that political freedom to the people of China, all 1.3 or 1.4 billion of them, who are becoming not only ever wealthier, but ever better instructed in what is going on in the rest of the world. The satellite television has made, and the internet have made, an enormous change. How much that change has been can be gauged by the efforts that China in particular makes to impede the access of the Chinese people to that knowledge. They're not very keen on people learning how the rest of the world lives. And I think those pressures are going to be relentless, but I'm not saying that the China of the middle of this century should look politically like the United States. There are many, many, many other forms in which this can be done, and probably forms which do not offer the same degree of individual freedom. I think a lot of Chinese people are a little afraid of what that would mean. So it'll have to be an evolutionary thing. But if you ask me, is freedom a better thing than unfreedom, I would say comprehensively, yes.
Stephanie, Needham, Massachusetts. Stephanie, you're on the air with John Burns.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask Mr. Burns, in his experience, what he thinks about the condition of the women of the world and how much that is contributing to the condition of the general world overall right now, and what he thinks the future will look like for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Women in this world, John?
Well, we've seen enormous changes in my lifetime. I've seen enormous changes at the New York Times, and they were long overdue and widely recognized now to have been. We have had a woman editor of the New York Times. We may very well have within 2 years a woman president of the United States. We in the UK are very proud that we have already had a woman prime minister, controversial as she was. So I think it's a glass half full, glass half empty situation. Enormous, enormous changes have been made. These changes will continue. And all I would say is anybody who argues against equality for women in all fields is a dinosaur. But I think that feminism, like other isms, has to be careful to make sure that it doesn't lap over into extremes. I mean, and I don't think it has in the United States. I don't think mainstream feminism has. But you only have to pick up a newspaper to find where feminism and other isms do become intolerant and absolutist. And I would say, look at what we've accomplished, we in the West, in terms of the advancement of women in the last 30, 40, 50 years, and how much more we can accomplish. But let's keep the conversation moderate.
I'm trying to picture people looking to imagine extreme feminism. I can't think of many writ large examples of that. Maybe you can. that Amazonia or whatever you might be picturing.
It's a dangerous example to cite.
I'm not sure what you're even referring to.
I don't want to be to fall into that. But look. I've often thought that that's a debate that it's better to stay out of. Enough to say that enormous advances, well overdue, have been achieved. I've seen it in my own family's life.
Yeah.
And absolutely terrific. And they would not have been accomplished without people who were feminist leaders who were prepared to beat pretty hard on the drum. But suffice it to say, I'm really trying to just illustrate my larger point, which is that let's try not to fall into the pattern of a sort of Manichaean discussion, good and bad, what George Orwell described in that memorable phrase from Animal Farm, four legs good, two legs bad. There's plenty of bad and plenty of good on all sides, and I think we should make sure that the discussion remains at all times civil and moderate.
Atlanta, Georgia, MacArthur, you're on the air with John Burns.
Hi, Tom. I have a question for Mr. Burns. I've been noticing this as of late. I think the problem is not that it's the governments and not the people. I think social media right now is putting a lot of the people in different countries in contact with each other. And there's a lot of similarities between Americans' ideas and Japanese ideas, all different countries. I think it's the governments that are not listening to the people, because I don't think people of different countries really have a lot of problems with each other. Just the governments can't seem to get along. And I wonder, is that going to change in the future?
John Burns, social media put the people in touch with one another, and something better breaks out.
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if that were true? But, you know, it's a frightening thing to see, as I have done, that some forms of political extremism get the people in their hundreds of thousands out in the street waving the red books, chanting their slogans. And I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't think that, you know, it's people good, governments bad. I think that at least in places where people have a choice about the government, it tends to be, whether we welcome it or not, that the governments represent, in some broad sense, the people who elect them.
Of course, the Islamic State has a lot of Twitter accounts too, so things can cut in many ways. John, what about the very style of journalism and structure that you have been able to practice in these 40 years, out there supported by, for most of that time, a quite strong institution at home and free to report as you would on the world? Does that go on?
Well, I hope so. I've been treading perhaps a little unwarily in this conversation, but I would say that I think we need to continue to worship the old gods of moderation and modesty above all. And there is risk. It's all very well for me to say this on an hour-long discussion program where I can speak to people all across America, but I think that celebrity, even a modest degree of celebrity, and journalism are a dangerous thing.
together.
The journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something of a trend, what with the social media and the, if I can call it, the me culture of our age. There's something of a trend in some of the journalism and the social media towards the celebration of me, towards a lack of modesty in the face of events, towards putting the I in the center of things. And, you know, I suppose there are many people out there, young journalists, who would regard me as a dinosaur. But I think, you know, keeping modest and observing the old rules of moderation, of fairness, and of balance should be the abiding golden rule.
So you're not retiring. Where are you pointing that notebook then on a contract basis next? Still abroad? Still around the world?
Around the world, at home. You know, I have great passions for certain sports, in particular Formula One motor racing, but I hope to be able to do a pretty broad range of things.
John Burns, we thank you for many years of unparalleled reporting, and we thank you very much for spending a little time with us today. Thank you, sir.
It's been a great pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
John Burns, 40 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, speaking with us today from Cambridge, England. Not entirely retiring there, as you can hear. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.